This is episode 239 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, September 30th, 2012. I am the Solo Monster, final September show for 2012. So we head into a new month here. And with a new month comes a new WWE show. I almost completely forgot that WWE's main event show will premiere this Wednesday on the ION television network. I know here in New York, it's Channel 3 on Cablevision. And they're loading up the first show because they've already announced a champion versus champion main event. Sheamus against CM Punk. This is the match that they teased on Raw a couple weeks ago and did not deliver because AJ Lee, if I remember correctly, AJ said, you know, a match like that must be built up over a period of time. And so they've simply gone ahead and just announced it. And that'll be on the main event this Wednesday, so if you get that in your area, check it out. Should be a good match. We have Raw to talk about. We have a little bit of SmackDown as well, some Impact, a couple of other news notes on the show on tap for this week. We'll start, as usual, with Raw, episode 1009 from Albany, New York. We had one really great match on this show, the return of Jerry the King Lawler from his home in Memphis with a tan that would make Heath Slater jealous. We had one really funny diner skit with Daniel Bryan and Kane, or Gerald. I'm sorry, his name is Gerald. Forgot about that. And an awesome segment involving Mick Foley and CM Punk. Probably the best thing on the entire show. In fact, CM Punk was all over this show, as he should be. He is the WWE champion, after all. So I can't really hate on this show. I can, however, hate on one thing that took place on this show. I'll let you guess what that might be. So let's just start from the beginning here. We got a cold open this week with Paul Heyman and CM Punk in the ring. Heyman called out referee Brad Maddox, or as Paul called him, Brad Maddox. And he being the referee who messed up the finish of last week's match, and he's the one who missed Punk putting his foot on the bottom rope. So Maddox came out, and the first thing I thought when I saw him is, this really is Garrett Bischoff all over again. Just, I don't know, just reminds me of the guy. They made fun of the situation with the NFL referees, which has since been resolved, thank God. And apparently Vince McMahon was all giddy backstage on Monday night about what the NFL was experiencing, which at the time was a great deal of turmoil as they were going through a referee lockout. They've been using replacement refs now for the first couple of weeks of the season. It's been an absolute disaster. And they have since reached an agreement to bring the old referees back. But Vince was very gleeful, because Vince in the NFL, there's no love lost there. It goes back, of course, to the XFL many years ago. And, yeah, apparently Vince could not wait to stick it to the NFL on TV and mock them. And unfortunately for Vinnie Mac, the NFL had the last laugh. It crushed Raw in the ratings last Monday, even with that screw job in Seattle at the end of the game. Just absolutely mopped the floor with Monday Night Raw, giving it not only its lowest number of the year, but the lowest non-holiday Raw rating since 1997. I wonder if Vince is smiling now. Anyway, Punk demanded that the referee resign, which he refused to do. Out came AJ, skipping merrily to the ring. Punk just completely embarrassed her on the microphone. He made reference to all of the non-PG things that happened between them. He told her to tell everybody that he was truly the best in the world between the sheets. Yeah, there must be something to it. I mean, when you really look at all the divas this guy has been linked with over the years, you know, Tracy Brooks, Daphne, Maria, Beth Phoenix, now Lita. I don't know, maybe it's the tattoos. Then again, Daniel Bryan has no tattoos, and he's betting Brie Bella, so maybe it's the beard. Facial hair and tattoos are apparently the key to hot women. I have neither. I guess I've got some catching up to do. So Punk is really digging himself a hole here in this segment with AJ. He's just completely embarrassing her, like I said. Heyman tries to calm him down, and then, inexplicably, he drops down to one knee and proposes marriage to AJ. I'm sure his wife wasn't too thrilled about that. This really didn't make any sense to me at all, other than it was just done to embarrass Paul Heyman. Just like the stuff with Stephanie slapping him during the Triple H Lesnar buildup. AJ ended up slapping Heyman and walking off, and that was that. And at first I figured Heyman did it. You know, there's a method to the madness here. I figure Heyman probably did that just to sucker AJ into slapping him. Being that the board of directors had warned her previously that she was not allowed to put her hands on any WWE superstar after she attacked Vicky Guerrero all those weeks ago. But she slapped Paul, and they never brought up any of that stuff at all. So if that's the case, then this made no sense to me whatsoever. Dolph Ziggler and Kofi Kingston had an awesome match. Just really great stuff. And as great as we all know that Dolph is, Kofi is severely underrated as a performer. He deserves better than just floundering in the tag team division. But as he told me when I interviewed him for Sound Off 212 in Miami, Kofi is willing to do whatever the company asks of him and needs him to do. And if that means helping to boost the tag team division, then he's cool with that. You know, he's the perfect utility player for WWE. I just think he's capable of a lot more, including being a heel. I really do. I really think that Kofi Kingston, you know, maybe with a haircut, put him in a suit, coming out as part of some heel faction, you know, he's good. He's a good enough talker where it could work. I'm not saying turn him for the sake of turning him. And again, maybe you don't do that. Maybe you don't want to just cut his hair and put him in a suit and make him look like everybody else. But I you know, he's a good enough talker where I think it could work. I really do. And I think he could grab the ball and run with it if he was given the opportunity to do something like that. So just something to keep in mind. I think they could be doing a lot more with Kofi. Lots of near falls in this match. Crowd was totally into it. There was one false finish that had even me going for a second. Dolph kicked out at the last possible moment, and in the end, he won with the zigzag, and that was that. Jim Ross was back on commentary this week. He accidentally referred to this as the main event when it was over. Then he corrected himself. Either that or he got yelled at, and then he corrected himself, saying that it had a main event level feel. And you know what? Looking back, it really was the main event on this show in terms of in-ring action. It was the best match on the entire show, probably the best wrestling match on TV all week. And by the way, WWE announced a deal to air much of their weekly content on Hulu Plus, which I'm sure many of you are aware of by now. You can subscribe. I think it's something like $7.99 a month and have access to shows like Raw, SmackDown, Superstars the day after it airs. Supposedly, they're bringing episodes of NXT from Full Sail University, which is not currently available on TV here in the U.S. They're bringing that to Hulu as well, so that's nice. But keep this in mind, and this is why I bring it up at this point. Based on some of the initial reports that people have sent in who have actually purchased a Hulu Plus subscription and they've tried to watch Raw, Raw, for example, is edited down from 3 hours to 90 minutes. Which, on the surface, sounds fantastic. I wish Raw was 90 minutes every week. The problem is, here in week one, they edited out the Dolph Ziggler-Kofi Kingston match. The best thing on the entire show. Aside from the Foley-Punk stuff was great. But in terms of actual action, I mean, this was by far the best thing on the entire show. And they also edited out the first diner skit with Kane and Daniel Bryan, which was the best of the three that they aired. They got progressively worse as the night went on. So, yeah, they could take their Hulu and stick it up their ass, at least as far as Raw goes. Just something to be aware of before you bust out your credit card. I guess, you know, for NXT, it's a cool thing, but are you really willing to pay $8 a month just to get NXT? I guess that's the question. If you're somebody who you don't have access to, I was going to say SmackDown. I mean, if you have cable, you should have Sci-Fi, but maybe you don't have Sci-Fi. Maybe you don't have access to Superstars. And a lot of times, some of the best wrestling matches probably go unnoticed because they are on a show like Superstars. So maybe in that case, it is worth it. But you know what? $8 on the surface doesn't sound like a lot, but to some people, it might be a lot of money. So it's just something to think about. We were taken to a diner where Dr. Shelby told Daniel Bryan they were going to do a little role-playing exercise. And Kane walked up wearing an apron. He asked if he can take their order. Brian ordered some vegan dish, which is funny because he's no longer a vegan. He developed an allergy to anything with soy in it. And being that it's so hard for him to find vegan food on the road, he just gave it up. I'm still waiting for him to turn the tag team title into a hemp belt, like he told us he would do with the world title when we interviewed him on WrestleMania weekend. So Brian also told Kane he would like to order a new tag team partner, which I thought was funny. And Kane talked about how he had thrown the chef into the deep fryer or something, chopped up little bits of the guy's beard and threw it into everybody's food, and then they showed some old lady gagging in the background. I thought this was really funny. I thought this was actually, like I said, the best of the bunch. And Kane also wanted to be referred to as Gerald, as it said on his name tag. So this was far and away the best one. There's no need, if you haven't seen Raw by now, I'm sure most of you have, but if you rely on this show, let's say, or other shows to figure out what the best things were, then you go back and watch it. You need not watch any of the other skits. Just watch the first one. Primetime Players beat Santino and Zack Ryder. Nothing much to it. They went a couple minutes. It was fine. Then we had Mick Foley making a surprise return to Raw to cut a promo on CM Punk, who made his way back out to confront Foley. Punk was just in full asshole heel mode on this show. The best thing he did actually came later on. He went to shake hands with some little kid at ringside, and when the kid reached his hand out to touch him, Punk just pulled away and left him hanging. It was glorious, is what it was. Anyway, Foley took exception to Punk, aligning himself with Paul Heyman. He said that Punk does not need a mouthpiece. He talked about Hell in a Cell coming up and how he made a name for himself being thrown off one of them. He tried to convince Punk to man up and agree to step inside, the cell with John Cena. What I don't get is, last week, AJ said that whoever wins the tag match would do a lot to convince her to give them a title shot. Well, Cena won, so why is it that Punk now has a choice on whether or not he fights John Cena? Since when does the champion get to decide their next challenger? They still have to explain this one. That bit of logic aside, though, this was a great segment. Punk and Foley actually worked together in one of these types of segments in Ring of Honor during the Summer of Punk many years ago. And it worked again here. Just great stuff. Perfect use of Mick Foley at this point. I don't need to see Mick Foley wrestling, and I don't want to see him portrayed as nothing more than a goofball. You know, if you want to parade him out there in a Santa Claus suit on Christmas, you know, he likes to do kid stuff. He writes children's books. That's fine. That might have even been his idea. But I feel like they've underutilized Foley. I don't need to see him on TV every week, but when we do see him, people don't seem to care because they never have him doing anything important. This was the first time in a long time where it really felt like Mick Foley was a main eventer. It really felt like he was being used in an important role to further a main event storyline, which he was. And I thought it worked fantastically. When he's serious and he really sinks his teeth into something, he's as good as anybody, is Mick Foley. Then we had Ryback against The Miz. Boy, they didn't waste any time with this one, did they? They just could not help themselves. Here I was thinking Hell in a Cell was too soon for them to have their first match. Little did I know that we would be getting it 1 week later on Raw. I should have seen this one coming. Shame on me. I was still holding out hope when they flashed the first graphic on screen teasing that this match was going to actually take place. I was hoping it was just going to be an angle. You know, they wouldn't actually end up doing the match. But nope. They did it. Not only did they do it, but they blew off the entire feud in 1 week. Now, I know they did the tease with Ryback and Punk at the end of the show, but they're not feuding Ryback with Punk at the pay-per-view. They're not putting the title on Ryback. As far as this goes, Miz got some offense, but Ryback basically squashed him. A fan foolishly ran into the ring during this match. Yes, they interfered during a Ryback match. How drunk do you have to be to run into the ring during a Ryback match? How big of a death wish must you have? Wouldn't it be more humane to just jump off a bridge or swallow some rat poison? Unfortunately, they were tackled so quickly that Ryback never really had a chance to swallow them whole. That would have been fun to watch. He beat Miz with his finisher, shell-shocked, and he pinned him. And the fans didn't really react all that big, and why should they? I mean, the match came out of nowhere. The fan interference did kind of take them out of it, I guess, but this was just an epic fail. This should have been a much bigger deal than it was, and they blew it. The worst part is that even if you aren't a fan of the idea, if you weren't a fan of the idea of having Ryback feud with Miz and eventually win the Intercontinental Championship, how do you justify having Ryback squash the Intercontinental Champion in a non-title match like he's nothing? This is what I talked about last week with one person who tried to make the argument that Goldberg could have beaten Raven back in 98 on Nitro without actually taking the U.S. title from him. I said that that was a stupid idea, and this is exactly why. If you lose a non-title match the way the Miz did here, you don't deserve to be the champion. There's no purpose in walking around with a belt around your waist, even a fake one. If Ryback is good enough to beat a champion, he should be the champion. It's just common sense. I hated this. The only thing they could do to walk this back a little bit, just a little bit, is if what we saw at the end of the show builds to a Ryback vs. CM Punk match on Raw, let's say this week or next week, for the WWE title, and at the end of the match, when it looks as if Ryback has Punk's ticket punched, Miz interferes, costs Ryback the title, and lays a beating on him. That way they can get heat back on Miz, and Ryback now has a reason to want to get revenge on this man. But even then, you know, they've already screwed the pooch on this one. They've already done the first match, and there was no debate as to who won that match. You know, they certainly didn't leave it open for interpretation. Ryback squashed him. Just incredibly short-sighted booking on their part. We got the second Kane-Daniel Bryan skit from the diner. They basically did a spoof of When Harry Met Sally, which was much funnier 7 years ago when they did this with Kurt Angle and Chrissy Hemme. Frankly, doing an orgasm bit with two dudes is not my idea of comedy, but hey, to each their own. Mae Young had a cameo at the end of this. Wade Barrett beat Tyson Kidd with his forearm finisher. Barrett has basically stolen Cassius Ohno's KO finish. That sucks. I wonder if Ohno shouted his last name when he actually saw that for the first time. Michael Cole was in the ring to interview Jerry the King Lawler via satellite from his castle in Memphis. I can only surmise it was a castle, being that Lawler was sitting on a throne. I sit on a throne too, but mine is made of porcelain. Lawler's was much nicer, I will give him that. It was funny to me that they were building this up all night as a world-exclusive interview, after Lawler had already given the Memphis media an interview from that very same throne earlier in the week, which was streamed worldwide on the internet. But I guess within the WWE bubble, this was a world-exclusive. I also could have done without, honestly, the still shots before every single commercial break of a clinically dead man laying motionless receiving CPR. I thought that was a bit questionable. I did not need to see that. Even if Lawler was okay with it, I don't really think it was necessary to show that. You know, what purpose is there in doing that? Lawler looked great. His voice was still quite a bit raspy from the breathing tubes that were shoved down his throat. He said the last thing he remembers that night was Bret Hart being in the ring with CM Punk at the beginning of the show. He has no recollection of his tag team match that night or anything else before waking up in his hospital room in Montreal. He did joke that sitting next to Michael Cole for 3 hours instead of two every single week, he was bound to have a heart attack. As soon as he gets the green light from the doctors, he said he would be back at the announce booth. I don't know that he'll be announcing, but he has already announced his intention of being at the SmackDown taping in Memphis, which is on October 16th. So that I guess technically would be his return to WWE. It could just be dark. I don't know that they would necessarily put it on TV. But they did not let JR say anything to King here in this segment, or vice versa, which I found a bit odd, given how closely associated they've been over the years. But Cole did fine here. He still comes across as a bit phony in his sincerity during these things as a babyface, but I think that's just the product of him being a heel for so long. Sheamus, Sin Cara, Rey Mysterio teamed up to beat Alberto Del Rio, David Otunga, and Ricardo Rodriguez. Ricardo was actually rather impressive during this match. He does wrestle, which some people may not realize, and he bumps around pretty good. He was actually put under a mask the very next night at the SmackDown tapings, and he wrestled a match against Sin Cara, for Saturday Morning Slam. It's supposed to air in a couple of weeks. Not sure if it was just a one-time thing, but he should wrestle more. You know, even if they do a dual gimmick with him and put him under a mask, I mean, hey, you know, one of the best things about WWE is Ricardo Rodriguez, much like one of the best things in TNA is Joe Park. And for a while there, he was doing two characters also. He was Joe Park and he was Abyss. So if he can make that work, I think Ricardo under a mask could work also. I think more Ricardo is not a bad thing. Another diner segment came up after this. This time Dr. Shelby wanted each man to eat something that the other person would normally eat. So Kane ate a salad while Brian ate a meatball. Kane burped. Brian fake vomited in Dr. Shelby's lap. I can just picture Vince McMahon standing backstage laughing his ass off at this. This type of comedy is right up his alley. In fact, it probably was all his idea, which is probably why I like this segment the least out of all three. They had a Raw active poll to determine the team name for Kane and Daniel Bryan. The choices were Team Teamwork, Team Friendship, or Team Hell No. I mentioned Hell No as a team name on the Sound Off last week. It was actually suggested by more than one of our listeners, so I was very happy to see that one win out over the others. Although I don't like that they're calling them Team Hell No. You know, it's like when Edge and Randy Orton were a team, they called them, I think they were Team Rated RKO, which just sounded completely stupid to me. Just call them Rated RKO. You don't need to call them a team. I realize they are a team. I don't need you to tell me that they are a team. It should just be Hell No. So Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow ran out to attack the tag team champions, and then they fled. Apparently the two of them now are a tag team. They're calling themselves the Rhodes Scholars, which is actually kind of a clever name, I will say that. It's not like they were doing anything with Cody as a singles anyway, so why not pair him off with Sandow, who seems to be getting a push of late? You know, can't get much worse for Cody. He can only go up from here. Eve Torres and Beth Phoenix beat the team of Layla and Alicia Fox. Sadly, Beth did not pull a Green Day when she came out. Match did not even go a full 90 seconds on a three-hour show. I had it at 1 minute 29 seconds on the Divas stopwatch. So 1 second shy of 90 full seconds. And after the match, Caitlyn came limping out on crutches on stage and said that security footage from Night of Champions showed that it was a blonde who attacked her backstage. Eve started pointing the finger at Beth, who denied having anything to do with it. I guess the big reveal will be it was Eve in a blonde wig. Either that or it could be an intriguing way of introducing Sarah Del Rey. But apparently Sarah Del Rey is now working as a trainer in developmental, so I don't think we'll be seeing her wrestle on TV anytime soon. And while I'm on the subject of the Divas, Kelly Kelly was released by WWE on Friday. It was said to be a mutual thing. Kelly had not appeared at all on television, I don't think, since August. She's been working on outside projects, and it was just a matter of time before it became official. This does continue the trend of Divas, both in WWE and TNA, because they're not immune to this either, choosing to leave on their own. I mean, in WWE alone, we've now had Michelle McCool, Gail Kim, Maxine, the Bella Twins, Beth Phoenix, Kelly Kelly, and reportedly, the daughter of Eddie and Vicky Guerrero down in developmental, Raquel Diaz, also asked for her release. Although, as far as I know, WWE has not released her. She is still under contract, at least last I read. But that's an awful lot of people in a relatively short period of time who have, on their own, requested their release. You have all of these women, all of their own volition, choosing to leave the biggest wrestling company in the world. National television exposure, the whole kit and caboodle, choosing to leave for various reasons. That's absolutely striking to me. And it goes to what I talked about recently on the Sound Off as far as how badly WWE treats the Divas division on television. It's just an afterthought to them. It's not money. You know, it doesn't draw. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you feel that way about something, you're going to treat it that way. Well, this is never going to work, so we won't give it a chance. Of course it won't draw. Of course it won't make any money. If you don't give it a chance, you've already given up. If you actually put some effort into it and give it time, maybe things might actually change. TNA proved years ago, not so much today, but years ago, that the women can draw. The knockouts were their main TV ratings attraction for a while. They were getting bigger numbers than main eventers like Sting and Kurt Angle and Jeff Hardy. But at this rate, there won't be any divas left to resurrect the division. I will say that the Beth Phoenix-Natalya match, I had a whole bunch of people tweet me and ask me if I watched it. So I finally got around to watching it yesterday. They had a match on SmackDown, and it was really, really good for the time that it lasted, which was a hell of a lot more than a minute 29 seconds, I could tell you that. I didn't use the stopwatch, but if I had to guess, it went a good 5-6 minutes. And that could very well be the last time we ever see those two work together, with Beth leaving soon. And if so, I think that's a shame. Not only that, but they gave Beth the win in her hometown of Buffalo. Not since Trish Stratus, I don't think, have they given a diva a win in her hometown while she's on her way out. So I thought that was pretty cool. Back to Raw. Big Show returned and knocked Brodus Clay and Tenzai the fuck out. Alrighty. Main event was John Cena, the one-armed man in pink, coming out for a promo. It's really too bad that Bobby Heenan is in the physical shape that he's in. If they ever turn Cena heel, we could avoid hearing these promos by just having Heenan talk for him. They could even call them Pinky in the Brain. Cena was back to being very annoying this week. He was doing his PG shtick, where he pretends that he wants to curse, but instead he just says a bunch of baby gibberish. This is one of the reasons people hate the man so much, is promos like this. But they keep doing it anyway. Punk and Heyman eventually came out. This is where Punk toyed with that child at ringside. That was quite great. They talked about Hell in a Cell. Punk made some very valid points about having already beaten Cena many times, and that it's now time for someone other than John Cena to get a title shot. And in the end, Cena nailed Punk in the breadbasket with a lead pipe that he was hiding somewhere on his person. I don't know where. I don't want to know where. And all I thought to myself when I saw this was, what a cheap shot artist John Cena is. Backstage, Punk walked by Mick Foley, who happened to be standing there, conversing with some random person. He kicked Foley in the guts because he felt like it, I guess. And then when he turned around, he was frozen in his tracks, and the camera panned away to show us Ryback, standing there breathing heavily. And that was how they went off the air. So obviously, they must be somewhat concerned that John Cena may not make it back in time for Hell in a Cell, and Ryback is being groomed as a backup plan. But I just can't see Cena not wrestling at the pay-per-view. I guess it's not a bad idea to have a plan B, but it does not change the fact that what they did with Ryback and Miz on this show was stupid and unnecessary. And if it was just done as a panic move because of the Cena situation, that makes it even dumber. You know, maybe the fans really take to Ryback as a threat to Punk and get behind him, and it makes him a bigger star out of it, but they didn't have to do what they did on the show with him and Miz. Unless it turns out that Ryback is actually a Paul Heyman guy. I guess they could do that, but why? What purpose would that serve? They put Ryback in the ring on SmackDown, I saw, with Tenzai. I heard they had a match. I said, oh, I have to watch this. Only went 2 minutes, but I was happy they finally put Ryback in there with another big guy. In fact, Tenzai's bigger than Ryback. He's not as thick as Raw. I guess in the midsection he is, but he's taller. Technically, in some ways, Tenzai is bigger, which made it all the more impressive when Ryback got him up on his shoulders for his finisher. You know, it wasn't exactly Brock Lesnar putting Big Show on his shoulders for the F5 for the first time, but it was still rather impressive. So I was happy to see Ryback in the ring with somebody like Tenzai, because, you know, victories like that are what make Ryback impressive. It's not impressive anymore to see him stack 3 or 4 jobbers up on his shoulders and beat them. You know, he did that at first, and it was nice. And now it's time for him to move on to new opponents, and so it was nice to see. Some other WWE news here. SummerSlam buy rate came in, and it's good news for Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar probably just earned himself a big fat contract offer from WWE next year after this year's SummerSlam buy rate came in at 350,000 worldwide buys, which was up from 300,000 last year, and makes it the most successful SummerSlam probably in the last, I think, 4 years. And interestingly, the breakdown of the numbers was 264,000 buys in North America, only 86,000 international buys, which sounds really low. I would be curious to hear from, and I know we have a lot of international listeners from a lot from the UK, but all over the world who listen to this podcast. I'd be very curious to hear from some of these people about whether or not Brock Lesnar is as big a name outside this country as he is here. Because, you know, when he was in WWE, it's not as though Lesnar was a big name. In the company, he was a big name, but Lesnar became more of a mainstream celebrity when he went to UFC and became UFC heavyweight champion. And that's when people said, people all of a sudden knew the name Brock Lesnar. And I guess that just never translated to other countries, you know, because maybe UFC just wasn't as big in other countries. I don't know, but I would be curious to hear from some of these people. The numbers here would certainly seem to indicate that that is not the case, that Lesnar is not a very big name outside the U.S. and I guess Canada. By the way, the WrestleMania 28 buy rate, some quick update on that. This was from this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter. The WrestleMania 28 buy rate did not, in fact, surpass WrestleMania 23. There was some question as to whether or not that would happen. And, you know, when the initial numbers came out in May, I believe, WWE sent a press release out, and they were touting, no pun intended, they were touting the fact that, you know, this was the biggest WrestleMania of all time. And in some ways it was, but in terms of the buy rate, it was not. WrestleMania 23 had done 1.25 million, and this year's WrestleMania fell a bit short. 1.23 million worldwide. That said, between ticket prices and pay-per-view prices being much higher than they were back in 2007, this does officially make Rock vs. John Cena the biggest match in the history of pro wrestling. And in terms of money made, Rock vs. Cena becomes the biggest match of all time, which I'm sure is going to make all of the Cena haters out there very happy to hear that. But John Cena deserves a lot of credit. I think Rock obviously gets more credit for that, but Cena deserves a lot of credit too, because it's not as though you could just put Rock in there with anybody and he's going to pull a number like that. You know, I think Rock at Survivor Series a couple of years ago when he was in that meaningless tag team match proves you can't just put Rock or any big name in there with a nobody. You couldn't put Rock in there, for example, with Dolph Ziggler and expect them to do numbers like this. You know, it took a main event guy like John Cena, who has been the face of the company for so long, going up against a guy who was once the face of the company and building it up over the course of a year. And what you see is that in the end, it paid off for them. So we'll see if this results in more year-long build-ups for other matches in the future. I would think that there's a pretty good chance that we would see a year-long build-up again for a main event match. And hopefully it's better than the year-long build-up we got for Rock vs. Cena, because until those last couple of weeks, I think the build-up left a lot to be desired, and there was some question as to whether or not that would have an effect on the buy rate, and in the end, it looks like it did not. So we'll see in the future how they book these WrestleMania main event matches. A couple of other random news notes here. According to the latest Figure 4 newsletter, I plucked this out because I thought this was kind of interesting. WWE has taken something of an interest in Ring of Honor. They seem to have put two and two together and realized that much of the good talent they now have in developmental came from ROH. It's just too bad they're about 3 years too late on this, because ROH is not quite what it used to be. I'm not sure what is meant by the fact that they have, quote, taken an interest in ROH, seeing as how they're now owned by a television company that has its own interests, you know, that being the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, but I guess we shall see. It's kind of an interesting note there. Also, how about this? WWE is apparently still considering Madison Square Garden as a potential host for WrestleMania 30 in the year 2014. This is in spite of the fact that they are already billing next year's WrestleMania as a New York, New Jersey WrestleMania. I mean, they're having the Hall of Fame next year at Madison Square Garden. They're you know, going back to the same market 2 years in a row might have worked for them 20 years ago, but for them to do that today, especially when they now take bids from cities all over the world for WrestleMania, I don't really know that it makes much sense to come back to the same market 2 years in a row. But the first WrestleMania did take place there, as did 10 and 20, and it would make sense for them to go back there for number 30. In fact, I thought it was the conventional wisdom until they announced that next year's show was going to be at MetLife Stadium. Obviously, they would not be able to pack 60 or 70,000 people into the Garden. I think Madison Square Garden only fits about 18 or 19,000, maybe even a little bit less, depending on the setup of the set and everything else. But, you know, they could always jack up ticket prices to make up for some of that loss. It's still not going to be the same. You know, again, you're talking about 18,000 bodies instead of 65,000 bodies. But, you know, they'd sell the building out in a heartbeat. That certainly wouldn't be a concern. I wouldn't mind it. It would be an easy trip for me to make. I just don't know how other people would feel about New York getting WrestleMania 2 years in a row. Essentially, getting WrestleMania 2 years in a row. I guess I'm kind of pushing New Jersey to the side. But, you know, they themselves are referring to WrestleMania next year as a New York-New Jersey WrestleMania. It's not just me. So let's move on to TNA here. I've got some things to say here about Impact Wrestling from Thursday night. I enjoyed seeing Samoa Joe win the television title. And that's about it. That's about the only thing I enjoyed on this show. This was probably the weakest edition of Impact since they went live at the end of May. This Aces and Eights stuff is just so stupid. It's just so stupid. And what the hell happened to the X division? It's like once Destination X came and went, so did the division. Where is Zema Ion? Are they just going to hold him out until Jesse Sorensen is ready to return? I mean, I usually rely on TNA to give me some of the best in-ring action each week, and WWE killed him on that this week as far as that goes, which is fine if let's say, instead of some great wrestling matches, if TNA's got some great idea for an angle, you know, that's fine. I got no problem with that. But if the Aces and Eights stuff was their idea of a big angle, then what a bad idea that turned out to be. This was, of course, the week that Hulk Hogan had planned to pay a visit to the Aces and Eights clubhouse in an effort to rescue Joseph Park, who they again refer to as Joe Parks. And not just Hogan, Sting did it. The Aces and Eights leader did it. So I guess they've officially changed his name now, which means that they're going to have to change the name of his law firm as well, from Park Park and Park to Parks Parks and Parks. Say that five times fast. I figured I would try to make Hulk's life a little bit easier by drawing him a map before the show with some visual instructions on how to find his way to said clubhouse, because as we all know, Hulk doesn't move around too well these days. His back is a wreck. I posted my map on Twitter for him to see. Sadly, he did not bother to take my directions. I suppose it would not have mattered, seeing as how he and Sting, who randomly returned on this show after being off TV for several weeks, both men were maced, or at least Hogan was, by some woman who came up to him backstage claiming that she had some papers from Bruce Pritchard for him to sign. And Hogan then began to sign the papers when he was maced. Why would he sign these papers without reading them first? I thought he was a better businessman than that. We'll see if this plays into the storyline at some point, or if it was just a diversion and nothing more. For all we know, Hulk could have just signed over control of the company to these guys. They were jumped at that point by Aces and Eights, who put hoods over their heads, threw them in the back of a van, and drove them, presumably to the far end of the building, so they wouldn't realize that their clubhouse is in fact simply a utility closet in the basement. And interestingly, one of our listeners pointed out on Twitter that the whole deal with them being thrown in the back of a van reminded them of Samoa Joe's abduction many years ago. Remember when he got kidnapped? That remains unsolved. I don't think they ever explained that to us. And that's an interesting point. Not only that, but as we would see later on in other segments on this show, I believe there was one Aces and Eights guy wielding a giant machete, similar to the one that Joe had when he eventually resurfaced with his whole Nation of Violence gimmick. He had the big knife. I don't know. I find that kind of interesting. Later on, we were taken to the clubhouse. We found Sting and Hogan with their hands tied sitting at a table with someone who I assume is supposed to be the leader of Aces and Eights sitting in a chair across from them with his back turned. The only thing we could see is that this person was wearing a backwards baseball cap. And then he opened his mouth and started talking, and within seconds, I said, "Oh God, it's Eric Bischoff." That's exactly what I said. Not a doubt in my mind that it was Eric Bischoff doing the voice in this segment. I've heard this man speak many times, many, many, many times over the last 15 years. And his voice, you know, the cadence that he uses in his delivery, everything, I can recognize it instantly. Now, this doesn't mean that in the end, whether it's at Bound for Glory or whenever they do the big reveal, that it's going to be Bischoff revealed as the actual leader. It could have just been them using Bischoff as a stand-in here, you know, just to throw people off, and it ends up being somebody else. But I sure hope to God it's not Eric Bischoff. That's one of the things I think I have found enjoyable about the show since I started watching Impact on a consistent basis is the fact that Eric Bischoff has been absent from my TV. And as great of a TV character as Bischoff can be, there's nobody better than Eric Bischoff at coming across as just a completely slimy prick of a heel. A guy that you want to just smack across the face. Eric Bischoff excels at that. But Eric Bischoff is also way overexposed as a TV character. And he's been off TV since they did that little angle all those months ago. And I'd like for him to stay off TV. But if this was all just a vehicle for him to regain some stake in the company, then what a waste this would be, in my opinion. So at one point here, Sting called the guy a piece of bleep. Well, he didn't actually say the word bleep. They bleeped what we were supposed to think that was the word shit, which is a good description of this segment. But in fact, the hilarious part of all this is that if you watch Sting's lips, he clearly said the word crap. He called him a piece of crap, and they bleeped it out. I laughed at that. Sting is a good Christian, though, I guess. So I guess, you know, he didn't want to go all the way with the obscenities. So the point of all this was to set up a match for Bound for Glory where Hogan and Sting would choose two guys to represent TNA in a match against two members of Aces and Eights. And if Team TNA wins, then the Aces and Eights is no more. So to me, that kind of telegraphs the finish of this match at the pay-per-view. So I guess when Aces and Eights wins, the stipulation is that they get full access. Full access? What the hell does that even mean? They're already in the building. How much more access do they need? And yes, before I get emails, I understand that Hogan put the Impact Zone on lockdown, and we're supposed to believe that the clubhouse is not really in the building and it's somewhere off-site. I'm just being silly. But guess what? So are they with this storyline. So I can be silly too. But really, they never did explain what they meant by full access. Full access to what? The TNA on-demand service? Catering backstage? We were left to ponder this question. Hogan agreed to this without asking for specifics. So between that and signing those papers without first reading them, not to mention him eliminating Magnus from the TV title contention later in the show while keeping Garrett Bischoff in the running, I'm beginning to question the judgment of this man as general manager. Aces and Eights showed us poor Joseph Park duct taped to a table, frightened for his life, and probably concussed after being bashed in the skull with a hammer last week. They said they were going to hold on to Joe for a few more weeks until the pay-per-view, and they promised that nothing would happen to him. And then they cut away, and the show just continued on. Like nothing ever happened. Boy, I'm sure glad I don't work for TNA. Everyone seemed to be perfectly fine with letting poor Joe Park stay tied down to a table against his will for another 2 weeks. I know it's pro wrestling, suspension of disbelief and all that crap, but you know what? This is just too much, even for me. Earlier in the night, Hogan had announced that after failing to come to a new contract with Devon, they were crowning a new television champion tonight. Hogan would decide between Mr. Anderson, Magnus, Garrett Bischoff, and Samoa Joe. Quite the motley crew of talent there. They would determine from those four which two would square off for the championship later on in the show. And they had this great segment backstage. They do this on like their championship Thursdays or whatever they call it, where each wrestler stated their case as to why they felt they deserved a title shot. And Magnus actually laid out a very compelling argument for himself, and he accurately pointed out that Garrett Bischoff had done nothing other than being Devon's little friend to even belong in the same room with the rest of them. So how was he rewarded for this display of logic? He was the first one dismissed. I would imagine this is how a lot of booking meetings go in professional wrestling. Best part of this was Magnus trying to leave, not realizing he had to pull instead of push the door open, and Joe made fun of him for it. So Before Magnus leaves, he looks right at Samoa Joe, he grabs his belly, and he starts shaking it as if to say, "Fuck off, fat boy," and then he walks off. I died. This was just great. Even Samoa Joe, before they cut away, could barely contain his laughter. So Magnus won some points with me here. This was good. We had Bruce Pritchard, Al Snow, and Taz out in the ring a few segments later to decide the fate of young gut check contestant Evan Markopoulos, who had a hell of a showing for himself last week in getting his ass handed to him by Douglas Williams. I said on the Sound Off last week that I thought he earned himself a contract. This week, he got some mic time, and he was really good. He really was. I think he's got something. He didn't come off as timid in any way. He seemed very comfortable out there. He even got a yes chant from the crowd. They all wanted him to win. Taz was impressed by him. He voted yes, but unfortunately, the Buzzkill twins, Pritchard and Snow, they both voted no, mainly because he's 18 years old and they felt he wasn't ready yet. And after Pritchard said no, Borash gave Evan a chance to kick out, which I think is really corny. But he gave him a chance to kick out on the microphone by saying a few words to try to persuade Al Snow before Al Snow voted. And Evan said that he was born in 1994, which just makes me feel so old I want to cry. He said that year Al Snow was trying to get into Smoky Mountain Wrestling and into ECW, and Al was a lot older than 18 at the time. And just like Al was willing to do whatever it takes to succeed in this business, so too would he to earn a TNA contract. And it was really good, I will say. Sometimes they give the microphone to the person and they stumble or they stutter. He did neither of those things. He was really good, and you felt like he was being very honest about it. You could tell he really wanted this in the worst way, and he was willing to do whatever it takes to improve and get better. You know, he looked more ready to me at age 18 than some of the much older gut check contestants they've had so far, and in some cases, ones that have been given contracts. So to me, that is a bullshit argument. Oh, he's only 18 years old. Not only that, but Al Snow sang this kid's praises for a good 30 seconds after that. It's not like he got on the mic and said, "You're too young." No. He talked about how he handled himself well in the ring, he handled himself well on the mic, you know, and if you're impressed by the kid's passion, you know, to me, if you're impressed by the kid's passion, and you go out of your way, as Snow did here, to say that he represents everything that Gut Check is supposed to be, then vote yes! Maybe Aces and Eights needs to kidnap Al Snow and bash him in the head with a hammer and knock some sense into him. This kid deserved a chance, and he got railroaded here. That sucks. He did take it graciously, though. That was good to see. It's not like he was moping around or he, you know, flipped him off and walked out of the ring or anything like that. You know, he handled it like a champ. He handled it like a pro, and I'm sure this is not the last time we've seen young Evan. At least I hope not. They announced James Storm and Bobby Roode will meet in a street fight at Bound for Glory with King Mo as the special enforcer. King Mo will be making his Impact debut this week on TV, by the way. For those who don't remember, TNA signed King Mo several months ago as part of a deal that allows him to continue doing MMA with Bellator Fighting Championships, which debuts on Spike TV in January. Bellator and Spike reached a deal almost a year ago, but because of the fallout in the relationship between Spike and UFC, there was a one-year non-compete. So Bellator has not been able to start up on Spike TV. They've been floundering on another network. But in January, they're coming to Spike. So you're going to start to see a lot of promotion and a lot of commercials for Bellator. And King Mo is a big part of that. It's all about network synergy here. And King Mo is actually a huge wrestling fan, has been since he was a kid. He was a big fan of Jerry Lawler, hence the King name that he adopted. He was actually offered a contract by WWE many years ago, but he turned it down to pursue a career in MMA. It's a little trivia note for you. Main event on this show had Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries beating Bully Ray and Bobby Roode. Jeff Hardy was rocking a zombie look this week with his makeup. There was dissension after the match between Aries and Hardy. Nothing much to it, really. We went backstage. Aces and Eights released Hogan and Sting out of the van. Sting went to go after one of them, but one of the Aces and Eights guys pulled a knife on Sting. He pulled a knife on him on TV. I mean, who does he think he is? Tank Abbott? And for those of you who don't get that reference, which is totally understandable as I've tried to block out the dying days of WCW from my memory as well, Tank Abbott is a former mixed martial arts fighter himself who joined WCW in, I want to say it was the year 2000. And Tank Abbott once pulled a knife on his opponent at a Super Brawl pay-per-view. And Tony Schiavone tried to cover for it on commentary by pretending that it was a pair of scissors and that Abbott was merely trying to cut the man's beard off, even though the man had no beard. Oh, WCW, how I miss thee. So that was Impact. Speaking of WCW, you look at the cast of characters here, it's kind of striking. You know, between Bischoff behind the scenes and Hogan and Sting, it is like WCW all over again. And with this Aces and Eights stuff, they're getting perilously close to those dying days of WCW. So they need to stay away from that. That would be very bad. I don't want to be reminded of the dying days of WCW. There's a reason WCW is dead. Let's get to shout-outs and mailbag questions from you guys. You can email me with your questions each and every week. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address. Johnny from London, UK, writes in. Says, could I please have a birthday shout-out? I turned 24 on Friday, October 5th. Can't believe it's been 5 years since you started doing the show. It's gotten better and better as time goes on, and I look forward to at least 5 more glorious years to come. So thank you to Johnny. Happy birthday. Technically, it'll be 5 years in November, but it's almost 5 years. Hard to believe. We have our 5-year anniversary coming up in early November. I guess technically by the second week of November, it would be 5 years. This comes from Bill Mitchell, a devoted Sound Off listener since episode 60-something. As you probably already know, you and I share the same birthday, but that's not all. My friend Paloma Vargas, who is an independent female professional wrestler based out of Texas, also shares our birthday. I was kind of hoping for a birthday shout-out, not only for myself, but one for her as well. I will be spending my birthday in Lawton, Oklahoma on that day, October 6th, watching her compete for Impact Zone Wrestling. Since there is nothing else I can get this awesome person that she doesn't already have, I figured what better gift than a shout-out on my favorite podcast from the Paragon of Professional Wrestling himself. Ah, stop it, you're too nice. You're making me blush. He goes on here, in case you want to roast me during said shout-out, I'll give you a reason. I'll be turning 35 on that day. I have nothing to look forward to now until 50, when I am sure I'll be getting my very own AARP card. Well, since you roasted yourself there, I won't pile on. That would be that would not be nice of me to do. But happy birthday to Bill. Bill is one of the good guys. He's been a listener and a supporter of the show for an awful long time. And I'm envious of the number of Twitter followers this man has. Thousands upon thousands of people follow this man on Twitter. So he'll have to share his magic with me one of these days. Derek Fox, listener since episode 60, has a question. Do you think Kevin Steen will have a run in WWE? I am a huge fan of his work in ROH with Scum, that being Jimmy Jacobs and Steve Corino. I really think a program with him and John Cena could turn out pretty good. You know, he's an interesting case, is Kevin Steen, because I like Kevin Steen. I think his character, his act in Ring of Honor is probably one of the few things keeping that company somewhat interesting these days from what I follow of ROH. And, you know, even when I was going more frequently to ROH shows in New York and attending them, and back then he was probably still teaming with El Generico at the time. But the fans are really into him, and he's a good wrestler. But here's the problem with Kevin Steen. And actually, before I even get to the problem with Kevin Steen, envisioning a Kevin Steen-John Cena feud actually would be pretty good. It has the potential to be good if it was booked to make both men look strong. If Kevin Steen were booked in WWE the way that he's been booked in Ring of Honor, the potential is great for him and Cena to do some good stuff. There's two problems with that, though. The most obvious problem, anybody who knows the Kevin Steen character and the promos he cuts, he's not a PG guy, okay? So Kevin Steen and ROH would never work in modern-day PG WWE. It's just not going to happen. Much like Bully Ray, who does not go on Impact and curse every week, but even the things that Bully Ray says, and Bully Ray in some ways is a more sanitized version of Kevin Steen, with better calves, of course, you know, even the Bully Ray character I don't think would necessarily work on in WWE because of the PG environment. But the other thing is, Kevin Steen is, he's not much to look at physically. Now, I personally don't see anything wrong with that, to the point that there is something to be said for guys who look like the everyman getting over. Not everybody has to have a six-pack of abs, muscles bulging out of places that they don't even know they have places. Okay, not everybody has to look that way. There is something to be said for a guy who has a bit of a stomach, who may not be much to look at, who may not have big muscles, who may not have a big, nice, bright tan. You know, people, I feel, everyday wrestling fans, can relate to people like that because they look like them. They sound like them. I'm willing to bet most wrestling fans aren't sitting at home with a six-pack of abs. They're sitting home with a six-pack, but it's not abs. So I think there is something to be said for that. People can relate to him more. But in WWE, it would never, ever work. He would never be given an opportunity to succeed in that company. And quite frankly, if you take away the current character, the current gimmick, the current act that he has going in Ring of Honor, and I don't mean this to sound, you know, it's a slight Kevin Steen at all, because like I said, I like Kevin Steen. But when you take that away, when you strip it away, what are you really left with? You know, WWE would look at him and just see a fat guy in a singlet. They would look at Kevin Steen and say he's a fat guy in a singlet. We don't get it. And it would never work. So that's why I see Kevin Steen having a run in WWE? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I can't. Even if they actually did sign him and put him in developmental, you know, would he get a run on television the way that Punk has had a run, the way that Bryan has had a run? I can't see it. He just does not look like a WWE guy to me at all. You know, at least if you're a guy who's kind of short, you still have a shot if you've got a unique look, if you're a high flyer. Kevin Steen doesn't have any of that. He's a good wrestler. He's not a fantastic wrestler. I don't look at Kevin Steen and go, wow, he's one of the best wrestlers in the world. He's a good wrestler. But guess what? There's a lot of good wrestlers out there. There's a lot of good wrestlers out there with a far better physique than Kevin Steen. And they will get opportunities before he does. You know, and maybe there's something to that. Maybe he needs to get himself in shape. You know, look at Samoa Joe in TNA. I love Joe, but for God's sakes, I mean, the guy could stand to lose a couple of pounds. It might do him well. Samoa Joe is not necessarily what he used to be. So maybe if Kevin Steen, you know, got himself in shape, and round is not a shape, if he got himself in shape, he probably physically would be doing himself a lot of good. It's probably not good to carry all that extra weight around. Then and only then do I think he might have a shot at WWE, and who even knows if he wants to go there. I mean, he might be perfectly content on the independent scene. But do I think that he'll have a run? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And the idea that WWE would even consider something like that, John Cena versus Kevin Steen, I know it's all pie in the sky. This is just a what-if scenario, but it's comical to me. Because they would look at him and they would see a fat guy in a singlet, and they would probably scratch their heads and think to themselves, what do people see in this guy? This question here comes from Adam from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Has a question regarding this week's SmackDown. What is WWE trying to accomplish with Antonio Cesaro and Wade Barrett? Might just be me, but in my opinion, these are the guys that should be feuding with Sheamus for the World Heavyweight Championship instead of Big Show. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Cesaro is the United States champion right now, and they're building him up. Antonio Cesaro, is he ready to meet Sheamus for the world title in a match? I'm sure they'd have a hell of a match. But there's no way Cesaro is ready to be in a world title feud. I mean, I'm a fan of Cesaro, but let's not get carried away here. He needs some more time as far as that goes. Wade Barrett, I would agree with you on. Wade Barrett unfortunately got hurt. His momentum was stalled. If it were not for the elbow injury, I think there's a pretty decent shot that Wade Barrett would already be World Heavyweight Champion. There was some rumor before WrestleMania they were going to have a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania and have Wade Barrett win. Or if, you know, they didn't have the Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania, they have the pay-per-view, obviously, he would win the SmackDown version of it. And obviously he got hurt. It did not happen. and they decided to tweak his character a little bit. He went back to his roots. He's a bare knuckles fighter. He's got this new finishing move now, which is far better, at least, than that wasteland move, which I thought was stupid. Wade Barrett is a guy who is ready, I think, to break into the world title picture, and I think a Sheamus Wade Barrett match, a Sheamus Wade Barrett program, for God's sakes, would be better than Alberto Del Rio and Sheamus. I'd be in favor of that. I see what they're trying to do with Barrett. They're trying to build him back up almost from scratch. I don't think you have to, though. You know, I think it was almost a mistake, quite frankly, to have those vignettes building up his return. I normally don't say that when they introduce somebody. I think that's fine for a guy who's making his debut. That's fine if you want to put vignettes together for an NXT guy like a Dean Ambrose or a Bray Wyatt or Seth Rollins when the day comes and he's ready to debut. I don't think everybody needs vignettes, but why does Wade Barrett need videos to tell us who he is? Do we not know who Wade Barrett is already? He's been around for a couple of years. He led the Nexus faction, which was one of the biggest storylines in the company in years and years. Not only did he lead Nexus, he led the Core on SmackDown as well. Two different factions this guy led. He was in a main event feud with John Cena. John Cena was his slave on television for weeks and weeks. I think people know who Wade Barrett is. I think they could have and probably should have, in all honesty, just booked something where Wade Barrett makes a surprise return on one show and attacks Sheamus, and now you've got a ready-made opponent set up for him. Wade Barrett is pissed. He had an opportunity taken away from him due to an injury. He's not going to let anything hold him back anymore. And now you've got these two big European dudes ready to beat the crap out of each other. I think that would be a fine idea, so... I agree with you on the Wade Barrett thing. I don't think they need to build him back up to anything because people already knew who he was, and he was already on the cusp. He was already on the cusp. He was on the fringes of a main event feud. And, it sucks what happened to him, but he's been gone for months and months, and I think that's probably how I would have brought him back. This email here comes from Erica E., 17 years old, lives in Akron, Ohio. I've been listening to your show since the late 100s, and this just so happens to be my second time sending you a question. Actually, two questions. The first one is, how long was WWE originally planning to have John Cena's September 2006 to October 2007 championship reign go until he tore his pec? I don't know. I had to go back and see if there was any planned pay-per-view match, which I think it was supposed to be him and Randy Orton. I could be wrong about that. Before he got hurt in that match with Mr. Kennedy on SmackDown. And then, of course, I think they did the thing at the No Mercy pay-per-view where Triple H beat Randy Orton in the first match to win the championship. And then Triple H beat Umaga. And then he lost to Orton, I think, in a rematch at the end of the show. So I don't know that they were necessarily going to keep the title on Cena, for that much longer. I don't recall them having long-term plans for him to have the championship heading into WrestleMania the following year or anything like that. So I don't know, and I don't know that we'll ever know, quite frankly. Second question is, what happens if the person who was scheduled to win a title in a match gets injured mid-match? Will the plans be changed, or would they still go through with it and have an injury angle? It all depends on the specific injury. I mean, the best example I could think of off the top of my head of more often than not, I would think they'd go through with the planned finish if the person is able to do so. If they literally break their leg in half or break their arm, then it may be awfully tough for them to continue the match at all. But just think of SummerSlam 1997. It was Steve Austin and Owen Hart for the Intercontinental Championship. The planned finish was Austin beats Owen with a stunner and wins the title. And unfortunately, Owen dropped him on his head with that tombstone pile driver. Austin was paralyzed for a good 45 seconds. Somehow managed to roll himself over, and they went with an improvised finish of Austin pinning Owen with a really poor-looking roll-up. So the plan was for Austin to win the Intercontinental Championship. They didn't change that plan on the spot. They could have called the match a draw or something like that, but whether it was Austin who said, no, I'm going to finish the match, or whoever's call it was, they continued with the planned finish of a title change, even if the final sequence was a little bit different. And Austin won the Intercontinental Championship, which, looking back, probably should not have happened. Got a big pop from the crowd, but Austin was not able to wrestle again until Survivor Series. And he had to give up the Intercontinental title because he wasn't able to defend it. So the title was vacant, and it was put up in a tournament, so Owen ended up getting the belt back anyway. And then Owen, of course, lost the belt back to Austin again at Survivor Series in 97. But that would be one of the more famous examples, I think, of a planned title change where the babyface was supposed to win. And even though he suffered a pretty severe injury, he continued on anyway and ended up becoming the champion. It's just too bad he wasn't able to defend the title. Steve from New York City. So, I just finished watching my very first episode of Impact tonight, and I have to say it was not that bad. I've seen Monday Night Raws lately that were much worse. I didn't hate it, but boy was it weird seeing Kurt Angle and Jeff Hardy and Bubba Ray wrestling again. I will likely watch again next Thursday. My question is, do Hogan and Sting consistently call Joe Park Parks, or are they just too dumb to know the name of their talent? They're too dumb. Matt writes in, I have only one mailbag question for you this week. It's regarding the DDP Undertaker feud back in 2001. I remember the storyline vividly, especially the segments of DDP stalking Undertaker's wife. Years later, I heard rumors and read reports that behind the scenes, this feud was a disaster. Apparently, Undertaker could not stand working with DDP and openly complained to him about him, I should say, to management. This contributed to DDP not being re-signed when his contract expired in 2002. I find this entire story shocking, as it doesn't really fit the personalities of either man. As far as I know, I've always heard that DDP was a really nice, well-respected guy in the business, and it's pretty much common knowledge that Undertaker has never been known as a backstage politician and has always seemed to steer clear of backstage drama. If the story is true, why did Taker despise DDP so much? Did he do anything to deserve this? Please help me separate fact from fiction. It is true that Undertaker is not known as a quote, politician the way that perhaps some other people might be, but that do not mistake that as meaning Undertaker did not look out for himself over the years. I just want to put that out there. I think there's this impression that the Undertaker is, you know, he'll put anybody over and, you know, he only looks out for others and doesn't worry about himself. That's not exactly true. Everybody looks out for themselves, but yes, Undertaker is not known for being somebody who, let's say, would kill pushes just for the sake of killing pushes or would be overly, paranoid about their own push. And DDP, you know, a lot of people are very friendly with DDP. They like DDP. My impression of it was always the fact that when DDP came in, and this is the problem, when you have somebody who is a big star somewhere else, you hear stories about it now with Sin Cara, and he gets heat because he walks around and you know, acts like he's a big main event guy, which he may have been down in Mexico, and he was. I mean, for many years, he was the John Cena of Mexico down in CMLL. Big star, made millions of dollars. But when you come to this country, and you come to WWE, now you're a little fish in a big pond. Quite literally, a little fish in a big pond. And things are different. You're not the star that you once were. And when you pretend that you are, or you still think that you are, that you're on the same level with guys who probably had to work their asses off for years to get to that position, here you come strolling in thinking that you're hot shit, it's going to rub people the wrong way. And I think that was a lot of what went into the dislike that certain people had behind the scenes, according to reports, for DDP. And I think Undertaker was also a bit put off by that. Now, I don't know of any specific thing or an incident that DDP did. It wasn't like one night at Raw he did this. I never heard anything like that. I think it was just his overall, the overall impression that he left with certain people. Maybe he knew he was going to work with Undertaker, and he started making suggestions, thinking that, you know, we'll do this, and we'll do this. I mean, I don't know. I don't know specifically what it was, but even then, I heard the same thing. I heard that, you know, Undertaker was not exactly a DDP fan. And listen, you don't have to pretend that you knew what was going on backstage at the time. I have two functioning eyeballs. If you just watch the way that whole thing was booked, you could just tell. Somebody had it in for DDP, whether it was Undertaker, whether it was Vince McMahon, because the first, quote, fight, which wasn't even an actual match, they called it a fight that they booked between the two of them, was at the King of the Ring in 2001. Go back and watch that. Watch how much offense DDP gets in on the Undertaker. DDP has his ass handed to him and then just runs away. He gets booted in the face, out of the ring, and I think he left through the crowd. He just ran away. And this is a guy who was a bona fide main event guy, a world champion multiple times in WCW, helped get himself over. you know, DDP has a very inspiring backstory in a lot of ways. You know, here's a guy who couldn't read until he was 30-something years old and didn't become a big star in wrestling until he was also at a point where most people would say he's too old, and he got over on his own. Very impressive. But when he came over to WWE, the story is he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He has a very high impression of himself, even to this day, has a very high impression of himself. And that's really what it was, whether it was the fight at the King of the Ring, whether it was when they booked Undertaker and Kane to beat DDP and Canyon, who were a tag team for a while. I can only remember one time where DDP got something over on the Undertaker, and it was during their feud. And I think DDP cut some hair off of Undertaker's wife's head on Raw once. That might have been the closest thing to getting heat on Undertaker that DDP got on TV. And then what ended up happening is, what I remember more than anything else, all these years later, is that Undertaker's wife beat up DDP on television. That says it all right there. But aside from that, I've never heard bad things about DDP. I've heard about, you know, the perceived big ego, but, you know, he seems like a nice enough guy. He's doing the stuff now with his yoga for real guys. A lot of wrestlers, a lot of guys actually use his yoga. And maybe these are people who at one time weren't DDP fans who now are. It'd be kind of funny if all these years later we end up finding out that Undertaker in his fragile physical state starts doing DDP yoga. I think that would be, talk about coming full circle. But Chris Jericho is an example of one main event guy who has talked openly about, in fact, he did a video interview with Belief.net, which I think is like it's a religious website. He did this like 10-part series of interviews with them, if you go on their website. And there's one video entirely dedicated to using DDP's yoga and how DDP's yoga essentially saved his life. So when guys like Chris Jericho and Shawn Michaels are using DDP yoga, that's pretty impressive. I haven't tried it myself, but I've heard good things about it. And, yeah, so that's the situation as far as DDP and Undertaker is concerned. I don't really think it was anything more than that. I think it was, you know, this guy thinks he's something he's not. Let's bring him down to earth and knock him down a peg or two. Andrew from Melbourne, Australia writes in, says, I really enjoyed the Night of Champions main event between CM Punk and John Cena. Having said that, the build-up was widely criticized as being lackluster, especially for a match 1 year in the making. I thought of WrestleMania 17's main event between Rock and Stone Cold, where in the build-up, and in order to put emphasis on the importance of the title, Jim Ross simply sat both men down for an interview as they discussed their desire of being champion and why they needed to win. Do you think something similar should be conducted more regularly in the future to help put over feuds, especially the main events? Absolutely. That's exactly the thing I pointed to, I believe, with Rock and Cena it was. Before WrestleMania, I said that's the sort of thing you need to do. That sit down with Austin and Rock in the back in front of the lockers. They're just sitting in a bunch of folding chairs with Jim Ross in between them. Two baby faces talking about why they have to win this match, why it's important to them. You could feel the tension. They were doing a very good job of building tension between the two of them. And it was just fantastic. It was absolutely great. You didn't have to do some corny angle where somebody gets hit by a car, where they crack jokes, or they rap. I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, this is supposed to be the biggest match in the history of wrestling, which it turned out to be. again, in terms of the millions of dollars it made, but, you know, it should be treated as such. It shouldn't be treated as a joke. I mean, why they were having rock concerts, and I love rock. Rock's an entertaining guy and all that, but there's a time and a place. Why you have a rock concert on TV a few weeks before the supposed biggest match in the history of wrestling is beyond me. It's just dumb. So dumb. And they weren't using Jim Ross really in any capacity. I mean, he wasn't announcing on Raw. So Jim Ross would be perfect in situations like that. It's how they use him now on some of the DVD releases. You know, the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels DVD rivalry set that they came out with was great. And nobody would have been as good in that role as Jim Ross, in part because he lived through that era. You know, he lived through it when Bret and Shawn were much younger. So he was, in every conceivable way, he was the perfect person to moderate that and ask questions. But Jim Ross excels in situations like that. And I think using him, you can't do this with every pay-per-view, okay? Because it loses a little bit of its panache, I think, if you do that. But when it comes to a big match like Punk and Cena, SummerSlam main event, WrestleMania main event, absolutely. absolutely. You know, they did something kind of similar on SmackDown many, many years ago when Undertaker was still doing the American Badass gimmick. And it was either before the first Brock Lesnar match or the second one, because they had two of them back in 02. The first one was at, I think, Unforgiven. It was a straight singles match after Brock won the Undisputed title. And that match ended in a draw. That was a shitty finish. The next month, they came back and they did the Lesnar-Undertaker Hell in a Cell, which was a great match. And Undertaker made Lesnar look like a monster in there. I mean, he was pouring buckets of blood. Brock beat him with the F5, 1-2-3. It was before one of those matches. They did this segment on SmackDown where there was a sit-down. I recall Stephanie McMahon was the general manager at the time. She may have been in the room. It was in a room somewhere. It wasn't out in the ring. It was in a room, sitting at a table. Paul Heyman was there. Lesnar was there, sitting across the table, you know, cutting a promo on The Undertaker. Undertaker sitting there looking like Cool Hand Luke, and then he responds. And it was a great segment. It was a unique way of building up a match, and to me, it worked. You know, I think they should do things like that more often, absolutely. And I think people would take the matches a little bit more seriously, and maybe they would actually be willing to plunk down some money and say, wow, that was awesome. I got to see this match now. They did something similar with Extreme Rules in April. It wasn't quite the same thing, but I raved about it when they did it, and they were building up the Brock Lesnar-John Cena match, which they did way too quickly, and the outcome, don't get me started on that, but the video packages they put together, particularly the ones with Brock in them, where it's a bunch of clips of Brock beating people up, the still shots of him in the UFC. I mean, it was shocking that WWE would actually show that. And it's just, you know, it was in the style of videos that you would see on a UFC show. And it's just Brock sitting there talking to some dude off camera about what a badass MF-er he is and about how John Cena's got piss running down his leg. And I just thought it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. Now, I was going to watch the match anyway, because just the draw of having Brock Lesnar back in his first WWE match was enough for me. But if you were on the fence about that match, I don't see how after watching that promo, you would not be excited to see that match, either to see Brock kick Cena's ass or to see Cena kick Brock's ass. So even if it's not a proper sit-down, there's a certain way that you can build up these big matches that make them feel special and make them feel more important. And it's not going to cost you any viewers. It's not going to cost you any potential buyers. If anything, you'll get more people willing to plunk down money to see these matches. So I agree 100%. We need more of that on WWE and TNA. You know, not for nothing, but TNA's biggest buy rate that they ever did came on a pay-per-view main event of Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe has the record as one of the biggest pay-per-view draws in TNA history. You might not realize that looking at the Samoa Joe of today, the way he's been booked. But at one time, Joe was kind of a big deal. And it was him and Kurt Angle in a cage at Lockdown, I want to say back in 06. And they did something like 60,000 buys on pay-per-view. I can't even fathom the idea of TNA doing 60,000 buys for a pay-per-view. I can't even fathom them doing close to half that amount. I mean, they're averaging anywhere from 7 to 10. On a good month, they'll do 15. But at one time, they built that match up something fierce, like a real sporting event. It felt like two guys, two athletes, Kurt Angle being an Olympic gold medalist and Joe being a badass, who wanted to beat each other up, and that's what their intent was in the cage. And the way they built that thing up like a real sporting event type thing, worked. And naturally, TNA decided, well, we're never going to book another match like that again. And they haven't even come close to doing the type of business they did that year. It's this weird thing in pro wrestling with promoters and bookers. I don't understand what it is. It's like, it's the inability to capitalize. When they stumble on something good, when they stumble on something that works, they have this unbelievably innate ability to do one of two things. They either ignore it and they never do it again. It's like they're allergic to it. They're allergic to money. Or it worked so well for them that they decide, we're going to do it all the time. And then they just beat it into the ground. It's one extreme or the other. There's got to be a happy medium where when you find something that works, use it every now and then, and you'll use it to great effect. It will actually work. It's not complicated. Anyway, that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Good questions this week. You can email more to me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything, and I try to respond directly. If not, I may answer your question here on the air. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. I may not have as many followers as Mr. Bill Mitchell, but I'm getting there. Follow me on there. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is our official Solomonster Sounds Off profile page. Not to be confused with the separate fan page, which you can like, if you would be so kind. And, of course, there's a group. We're all over Facebook. There's an official Sound Off discussion group as well. You can apply for membership, and I will approve you. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Sound Off for free in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It'll come right up. A lot of people have left some really good reviews, really positive feedback left in iTunes for the show. I very much appreciate it if you would leave a review and rate the show. It really does help. It helps the show's ranking and all that good stuff, and it makes me feel good. So I appreciate that. And that's going to do it for this week, the final Sound Off for the month of September. We will be back next weekend. It will be the first October Sound Off as we head into my favorite month, my favorite holiday coming up at the end of the month, that being Halloween, which means we'll probably do a Halloween show, maybe. I don't know what day. I think Halloween falls on a Wednesday this year, so maybe we'll do a Halloween-type deal the weekend before. We'll see. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Have a good week. Enjoy whatever shows you may be watching. Don't forget that new main event show premieres on the ION Network on Wednesday. So WWE has just about succeeded in their goal of having a wrestling show on the air somewhere in the world every single day of the week. Just fantastic. See you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.